brethren and sisters, so much of the introductory hymn that Brother Ewan picked I thought was appropriate to the subject that I have my hymn book here before me. And the third stanza of that hymn, hymn 113, serves as a very fitting introduction to our thoughts this evening. Lo, in the desert rich flowers are springing, streams, ever copious, are gliding along. And, let us stop when I get a bit emotional before I start. Forgive me. So, our subject, Israel. Our opening study was on the King of the North, which was followed by the King of the South. In the book of Zechariah in chapter 6, we read that the prophet saw a vision of four chariots coming from between two mountains of brass. And those two mountains of brass were the two powers, the northern and southern powers, which have really dominated the politics of the land of Israel. The king of the north, at the latter days being the Russian autocracy enthroned in Turkey and controlling the world, essentially, as Brother Steve said this morning. Some nations escape out of his hands. The territory occupied by the king of the south in Egypt is not amongst those nations which do escape out of his hands. The king of the south is ousted from his position in the southern area of Egypt. But what's significant from a sign of the times point of view is for this to happen, for that state of affairs that we know will prevail at the coming of Christ, at the descent of Gog, Israel has to be there in the land. As both Brother Steve and Brother Phil commented in their addresses, Brother Thomas could not see what we see before us today. Brother Thomas was not able to witness Israel in their land. So that prophecy in Ezekiel 38 of them coming against that land brought from many nations, that prophecy, which is partly fulfilled in our day, was still all a matter of expectation in the time of Brother Thomas. We in these days, the last days of Gentile times, are able to see the setting of the scene for the final enactment of the drama. Well, that picture there is a picture of modern Israel, and we can see the well-known flag of Israel with that Star of David, which throughout the generations has been a brand of their infamy in the eyes of the nations. It's now a sign that Israel have their own state flag, they have their own nation, they are there in the land, they're not there with the diadem and the crown, but they are there, ready for the final stages of God's plan before the establishment of that kingdom upon the mountains of Israel. Now the interesting thing to think about is in our introductory reading in Isaiah chapter 18, we read about this land which had been spoiled by the rivers. We know that rivers, as in the river Euphrates in Revelation, refer to nations whose land the rivers have spoiled. Whose land the rivers have spoiled. You must keep that thought in mind for a moment, but just have a brief think before we move on to the next slide that lush verdure there, which is actually a vine being traced along trellises and framework there, characteristic of modern Israel, is a sign that in part we are seeing once again the prophecies being fulfilled. Those prophecies of which we had the other hymn, a rose shall bloom in a lonely place, a wild shall echo with sounds of joy. It's not fully fulfilled. It's not fulfilled in its completeness at all. But we are starting to see in earnest a fulfillment of that prophecy also. Moses, of course, looked across from the eastern side, from the Jordanian areas, and he described it as that fair land beyond Jordan. For a very long time, even perhaps you might say at present, Israel would not be described as a fair land. But keep that thought in your mind. I have a translation from Brother Thomas, which reads as follows of Isaiah chapter 18. Hark, a multitude of many peoples making an uproar as the noise of seas. Hark, a tumult of mighty waters. They rage against peoples like a roar of many waters. But he shall rebuke them, and he shall flee afar off, and he shall chase him as the chaff of the mountains before the wind, and the stubble before the whirlwind. Behold, also at evening time, sudden destruction, and before dawn he is not. This is the portion of our spoilers, and the lot for them who scattereth. Ho, land of widely o'ershadowing winds, extending from beyond to rivers of Cush, which sendeth by sea whirling things, even upon vessels of fleetness on the surface of waters. Go swiftly, these fleet messengers, to a nation carried away and oppressed, to a people terrible from this and onward, a nation prostrate and trodden down, whose lands rivers are spoiled. Fleet messengers. Who are the fleet messengers? Go ye swift messengers, we read here, to a nation scattered and peeled, or in vessels of bulrushes. And Brother Phil, in his address on Isaiah 18, explained from the etymological perspective why Brother Thomas had translated it in that way. We won't be going into that detail here. We're just taking a surface level view of a few subjects here. But Brother Thomas has translated it as whirling things on vessels of fleetness on the surface of waters. Go swiftly, ye fleet messengers. Commenting upon this, Brother Thomas says, what could be a better description than the steam engine, which has propelled with fleetness, with real speed, the vessels of the merchant navy and both commercial and military, as in that case here, that's the HMS Warrior, stationed and refurbished in Portsmouth Harbour, which is propelled by both steam and sail. What Brother Thomas was pointing out was that this prophecy was specifically referring to the work of Britain in reviving that Jewish state. It was being sponsored by the British government, and it was a narrow time frame in which a series of events could come together to override the ever-present and prevailing anti-Semitic feeling which has dominated the politics of the nations throughout the past two millennia. It was a narrow time frame in which tradition could be overturned, and for a sudden moment in time, the superpower of the time, the British power, was able to support the Jews in their diaspora and give them support for a return and a re-establishment of their state, as we come on to. So this is a context for the times in which we live. As we said, rivers spoiling the nation has reference to nations spoiling the land. This applies in a number of senses. First of all, we can think of the many and various religious abominations which have desecrated the land of Israel. And there, that's a viewpoint from a Catholic Austrian section of the land of Jerusalem. looking out on minarets along with Jewish inhabited / Arab inhabited homes, and on the left, the far left of course, is the familiar and iconic abomination of desolation, the Dome of the Rock, the most famous of them all, and as bad as any of them. So that's a good example, that's a good viewpoint of Jerusalem, which shows how the land has been spoiled by the rivers. How many nations have come in and have tried to stamp their footprint upon Jerusalem. I read that there were 70 conquerors which had stood upon the soil of Jerusalem, each one trying to make their mark, each one believing that this land of Jerusalem is in some way sacred, and seeking to put their mark in the pages of history and add in a few abominations to go with it. As we develop our thought, we just have a look at Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 11. We'll be coming back to chapter 18. But thinking of that iconic Dome of the Rock in the top left of that picture, we read from Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 11, in the context of that vision of the seraphim, the vision of glory, the vision of when the abominations would be hurled from the land. And the question comes from Isaiah, then said I, Lord, how long? How long? And he answered, until the cities be wasted without inhabitant, and the houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate. In some senses, it's been the work of the Turk that has given us the view of Israel that has prevailed in modern times as a land which is far from a land filled with milk and honey, but one which is perhaps more desert conditions, I suppose. The landscape of Israel is very varied. But the Turk, when they came into the land, they destroyed everything. They were a very destructive power. They were, in the words of Daniel, an abomination that maketh desolate. They were a desolator like none of the others before them. I believe that they touched trees to the point that our guide in Israel said that there were at one point only 200 trees left in the land. So what we have to realise is that throughout the best part of two millennia, Israel, though not inhabited by Jews, was actually a land which was fertile, which was suitable to be toiled, the land used for growing crops, etc. And then along come the Turks. And when the Turks come along, then we get this description of the cities wasted without inhabitant, the houses without man, and the land utterly desolate. So that by the time we get to the point when Israel, the Jews, are looking to re-inhabit the land is in this state of desolation. So there we have a prophecy before us that we are seeing fulfilled, seeing the reversal of it. We've seen that land in its waste condition, being barely populated, and the reversion to its former glory to some extent, to a very small extent, with the return of the Jew. Of course, this is a modern day picture of Israel, so we wish to emphasize the point. We're not trying to say that the desert blossoming as a rose is completely fulfilled. But if we have a look at Ezekiel 37, I'll tell you what, I think we've got it on the next slide. We won't turn to it. We read there, I will also cause you to dwell in the cities, and the waste shall be builded, and the desolate land shall be tilled, whereas it lay desolate in the sight of all that passed by. And they shall say, this land that was desolate is become like the Garden of Eden, and the waste and desolate and ruined cities are become fenced and are inhabited. Then the heathen that are left round about you shall know that I, Yahweh, build the ruined places and plant that that was desolate. We read in Isaiah 35, verse 1, that chapter which forms the basis of our hymn 111, the wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. Or Isaiah 44, fear not, O Jacob, my servant, and thou, Jeshurun, whom I have chosen, for I will pour water upon him that is thirsty, and floods upon the dry ground. I will pour my spirit upon him that is thirsty, and floods upon the dry ground. And they shall spring up as among the grass, as willows by the watercourses. The point of these passages, and the point I've been trying to drive home, is that we're seeing a transformation, not just in the ethnic state of Israel, not just in the religious shape of Israel or the political position of Israel, but even in the topographical and geological sense, we're seeing a transformation. We're seeing the land start to blossom as a rose. So let us move on to the subject of the Jew himself. We've off-quoted this one, so we don't need to spend too much time reading through it, but yet I can't say it better than Mark Twain said it there. He describes how we have the Egyptian, the Babylonian and the Persian. They filled the planet with their sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed and made a vast noise and they're gone. And he says that the Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? One thing which Mark Twain there didn't comment on was the obvious persecution which has haunted them in all the lands to which they've been driven. We're seeing a revival of this, and this is not an anti-American stab, because Britain have themselves turned their back on Israel, but we're in the situation today where Israel probably feels without a friend. The other hymn, which I think is appropriate, is hymn 130. We read the second stanza, has thy night been long and mournful, all thy friends unfaithful proved? Have thy foes been proud and scornful by thy sighs and tears unmoved? All thy friends unfaithful proved. Napoleon promised them help at one time, so the French power were the first to suggest the idea of a homeland for the Jew. Napoleon's expeditions in the Middle East were a disaster from his point of view, even though back home he was heralded as a hero. But the French then later on gave the Jews the nuclear reactor, whilst soon after turning their back on them and giving a nuclear reactor to Saddam Hussein. The British, of course, ultimately they brought them back to the land, they gave them the support, and then themselves turned their back on Israel and even perhaps at the worst time they refused any support in the 73 Yom Kippur war, which was Israel's direst need. And they refused even for the Americans to refuel their planes in Britain, which were going in support of the Jews. But now their latest friend, America, is again starting to become a broken reed. And so, just as the prophecies which we have right back to Deuteronomy 28, Israel in unbelief, in denial of their Messiah, will only inevitably receive suffering at God's hands. It's only when they return and accept what God has said, including what God has said to them in the New Testament, that they will be again grafted into their olive tree. So let's move swiftly on to look at the modern signs of the times in relation to Israel. This is a brief summary of all the things we're going to discuss in time. I don't know how well you can see it there, probably not very well, but we're starting off with the Elks Israel. We've got some specific promises concerning Israel, which I think I might skip because we will be aware of them. We'll just briefly mention that we know they would be scattered and that they would return, but also that they would return in unbelief. So their situation, even in their unbelief, is what we would expect from Scripture, because we know that it's only with the appearing of Christ that mourning across the land will result in a national repentance. It's only in the direst calamity and with their redemption by the Messiah himself that they will be at last liberated from their unbelief and perversion. So the first point that we've got noted on this timeline is 1848, which is Elpis Israel. Apart from being a significant time throughout Britain at large, from the truth's point of view, this was a point of turning. This was a pivotal point in the truth with the writing of Elpis Israel. And here Brother Thomas commented upon the return of the Jews, and he said that the pre-eventual colonization of Palestine would be on purely political principles, and the Jewish colonists would return in unbelief of the messiahship of Jesus and of the truth as it is in him. They would emigrate thither as agriculturists and traders in the hope of ultimately establishing their commonwealth, but more immediately of getting rich in silver and gold and cattle and goods by their industry at home and abroad under the efficient protection of the British power. If it wasn't written so long ago and we still had copies of the original, we find it hard to believe it wasn't written after the time. But it shows how tainted Brother Thomas's works were by his broad and holistic view of the scriptures and understanding in the minute details of the prophecies. And he realized that things had to happen sequentially. And it was only with the return of Christ himself that the Jews would believe in the Messiah, but that their presence there already was also necessary for Christ to appear there. Another man contemporary with Brother Thomas, a man who in mortal things would have accomplished a lot more than Brother Thomas, but has faded into oblivion, was sadly another of many others of the Jewish people. And that is Theodor Herzl. And Theodor Herzl was a very energetic individual. An individual who went before the Kaiser of Germany, he went before the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, he went before the British, he went before all these people in efforts to gain a homeland for the Jews in Israel. Interestingly, his life ended shortly after he'd made a proposal in a Zionist Congress that Uganda would work as a temporary settlement for the Jews, and shortly after he died, as some say, from a broken heart, because it wasn't that well received by the Zionist Congress. But certainly his work was was of great consequence and great influence, and he said in 1897, on the first Zionist Congress which was convened, he said, were I to sum up that Congress, the Baal Congress, in a word, which I shall guard against pronouncing publicly, it would be this: afar I founded the Jewish state. If I said this out loud today, I would be answered by universal laughter. Perhaps in 5 years, and certainly in 50, everyone will know it. Perhaps Herzl could read the situation amongst Jewry at the time, and he could sense that events were tending towards something happening here. The Jews had been in a dispersion for millennia, but there was a very acute spirit of anti-Semitism which he observed, and he observed a spirit of reform perhaps amongst the Jews themselves, and he'd seen those vast numbers congregated there at that conference and realised that he was watching history in the making. He was watching a turn of events which should bring about the return of the Jewish people to their ancient homeland. And it was described in Ezekiel in the Valley of Dry Bones, which we're familiar with. There was a noise and a shaking, and then bone came together, bone to bone. And it says in Ezekiel that there was no spirit in them. No spirit in them. So there was to be a process, like Ewan was describing earlier, the process of spring to summer. There was to be a process which should not immediately result in the resurrection of a Jewish people in belief of the Messiah, or even in belief of God. But there was to be that noise, the shaking, and the gathering bone to bone of that great multitude of bones in the valley which Ezekiel saw. Herzl was the positive side. There was also clearly a negative side. And here we read of the Russian pogroms. And this was in the Christadelphian in 1882, which was quoting from a Jewish rabbi who was talking in the Times and saying that the English public needed to become aware of what was going on. What was going on in Russia. We're familiar with what happened in Germany. It's commonly known amongst people. Although there are those who, for whatever reason, probably just pure unmitigated anti-Semitism, will try to deny the Holocaust. Nonetheless, the pogroms of Russia are certainly less well known, but you can see there the infamous wicked deeds that were perpetrated by the Russians. We remember that the Cossacks were so fearful to go to my ear that apparently she'd hear the sound of horses' hooves and would wake up in the night in a cold sweat because she knew what the arrival of the Cossacks meant to her when she was back in Russia. So we can see that all that was done against the Jews there was exactly on the scale in terms of its cruelty with what happened in Nazi Germany. It wasn't the same in its extent because the Germans reached out into Poland, into Austria, into Czechoslovakia, into all those nations of Europe and tried a systematic purging of Europe from the Jews. But anti-Semitism was not new to Nazi Germany. And anti-Semitism has been synonymous with Russian feeling for a very, very long time. Concerning this, we read again in the Christadelphian in 1883, the Jewish persecution has done more than anything in the workings of Providence to lead in the direction of Jewish restoration. And we have the Balfour Declaration. We don't need to spend too much time on this either. But this was another time, as we've referred to already, where the hand of God was working to bring together a series of individuals. There was Lloyd George and there was Arthur Balfour, whose signature is at the bottom of the declaration there. And there was Jane Wiseman, all of these people who we don't need to talk about in particular. All of these people were together at the right time and influence the decisions of the cabinet in favour of Jewry. And Samuel Herbert, of course, was in the cabinet, who himself was a Jew by blood. Not longer, of course, not long after, Allenby marched into Jerusalem. It was in the December of that same year that, as a Christmas present, in the war, which wasn't going too well at the moment, not that any time in World War I was going particularly well for any part, they decided to march in on Jerusalem and liberate Jerusalem from the Turk, to the delight of the Jewish people. And there is General Allenby, who was advised to dismount, strongly advised dismount was what was sent to him on a memo. And so dismounted his horse, walked in on foot, and with that, the Turkish power was dried up from the land of Israel, with the work of General Allenby and the British. And so Britain, at this time, were able to put into effect the Balfour Declaration in a meaningful way. In many ways, we could say that they reneged upon that agreement in some senses. But there's no doubt about it that with the British in the land, there was a power which was supportive, at least of the concept of the Jews returning to the land and re-establishing there a commonwealth. Note also, which is interesting in this picture, that you can see in that alleyway, I think it is, the Turkish flag hanging behind. So we must not forget also that the way of the kings of the East was prepared by the drying up of the Turkish power and the work of the British in marching through this land of Israel. The revival of Hebrew. Interesting here that S. Burnfield, I don't know who he is, but he said that basically transforming Hebrew into a spoken language is impossible. He said, right or wrong, I don't know, he said no language or even dialect has been revived after having ceased to be a spoken language. Broken glass cannot be mended, nor can a language whose natural development has been arrested and is no longer alive in the mouths of the people become, as history demonstrates, anything other than a literary or religious speech, but not a people of living public speech. So he's basically saying that even in 1912, when he was writing that, that he didn't believe the revival of Hebrew was a feasible thing whatsoever, and that no language had been revived before, and he didn't expect it to be revived now. But even the revival of the language in the modern times, we have to see as a work of providence, and a work which is in readiness for the coming of Christ. Because we read of one language in the coming age. I know that in its fullest sense, that's in reference to the religion, that there would be one language. But it would seem very appropriate for the language of Israel, the Hebrew language, to become the language of the populace of the millennium. So we're aware of the life of Eliezer Ben Yehuda, a fanatic who gave up a life of luxury in Europe to live a very hard and difficult life, plagued with tuberculosis, losing his first wife and his children, some of them, and receiving persecution even amongst the Jewish quarters of the population of Jerusalem, but yet assiduously laboured on and single-handedly reintroduced the language of Hebrew, wrote his own dictionary to bring it up to modern times, and today we have the result, a language which is spoken as the language of the modern people of Israel. 1945 is World War II, and the result of World War II was again forcing the Israelites, the Jews, back to their land, even those who might have been contented and happy living in Europe. They now realised that there was no option but to return from Europe back to the land of Israel. There was no home for Israel outside of the land of Israel. And also what the World War II did was give a context in which it was difficult for the nations of the world to to deny in the United Nations vote of 1947, to deny Israel the right to a land. Perhaps in any other time, they could not have got the support of the United Nations, because, as we know, anti-Semitism has been the predominant feeling amongst all nations, really, particularly Europe. So the War of Independence. Let's move through these modern day wars, which have brought us up to the modern day. We've got the first war, the War of Independence. We can see what the United Nations mandate gave. It didn't actually give Jerusalem to the Jews. We can see the blue there to indicate the areas to be controlled by the Jews. Jerusalem was proposed to be an internationally administered corpus separatum. It used to be a so-called independent city, if there is such a thing when it comes to matters which are so emotive. But there on the right is the famous scene of David Ben-Gurion reading his Declaration of Independence speech, which he had hastily written. I believe it was on kitchen paper or something like that, and it was hastily scribbled together. And there he is, flanked by two flags of Israel, overlooked by a picture of Theodore Herzl. And in a moment of great significance, not just to the Jews, but to us as Christadelphians, David Ben-Gurion, a socialist, an unbeliever, proclaimed that state as a modern state in the modern world. Israel was a land once again. But of course, at the same time, David Ben-Gurion realized that this meant war. When the news came to him, he was disturbed from slumber, and it was reported to him that the United Nations had voted in favor. His reaction was rather unexpected, perhaps. He just asked for a pen and started writing the independence speech. And he looked out over the celebrating Jews and he said, "Why are these people celebrating? This means war." And war, indeed, did follow. The next day, the attack started from the Arabs. In this war, the difficulty the Jews had was that the British had forbidden them to import arms. They'd forbidden the Arabs to import arms as well, but of course, the Arabs were already established states, so there wasn't so great a concern. This was a fledgling state. They'd just been brought into existence, and the British were refusing for them to import arms, so they had to do it illegally. You can't see it too well, but if you look at those sections, on the map on the left, the cream section is where Israel had to retreat to. Particularly note that little finger which points towards Jerusalem. You can probably see it just where you can see the Transjordan on the right. If you look down, that little finger, that green finger pointing into the green territory, is that little stretch which went from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. On the map on the right, you can see, perhaps, I hope you can see, maybe you can't, but you can see a series of dots down in the south. Those were isolated Jewish settlements. So there's a distinction between conquest and isolation. Many of those settlements withstood tanks, armoured cars, aeroplanes, with just guns, rifles, sticks, stones, essentially, and managed to maintain their independence just through their sheer grit and determination. And of course, let us not forget, because God was with them. And when we look through history, this is what we must remember. When we look through history, we look at all the natural events. And if you read a history book, they say it happened because of this, and this, and this, and this, and this. And that's why it happened. But the question is, why did this happen? And this, and this, and this. And why did it all happen together? And how did it happen not just once, but it happened here and here, and it happened repeatedly, and then the wars resumed back in 56 and in 67, 73, and again the same miracles were reenacted. We must not make the same mistake as the historians, and when we see natural events, think that they are purely natural causes. The hand of God was at work here in ensuring that his purpose and his people were intact despite of the efforts of the nations all around them. So we pointed out that little figure of Jerusalem leading from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. What that meant is that the Jewish inhabitants of Jerusalem were in a very, very precarious position. What it meant is that they were surrounded by enemies, and to get even supplies of food and basic necessities to them was a very difficult task. To this day, the Jews have left, remaining on those areas, those highways leading up to Jerusalem, the remains of failed attempts to bring food to the people of the Jews in Jerusalem. So these people would come at some point, they'd come in armoured cars, they knew that they were going to be attacked, but they'd still, out of desperation and love, I suppose, for their fellow people of Israel, they'd just seen what had happened in the Holocaust, and there was a burning desire to keep these people alive. They'd drive these armoured cars through enemy territory, even though they knew there was a strong risk of death. And at some point, there was one point in which I think it was 40 convoys of armoured cars were burnt up, and not one single vehicle made it to Jerusalem. Israel had been in sieges before. Back in Deuteronomy 28, we had been told that they would suffer siege, and sieges did happen. Israel, Jerusalem here again, was under siege. Abdul-Qaeda Husseini was one of the Arabs, one of the famous Arabs around this area. His words were, "We will strangle Jerusalem. We will strangle them into submission." But this was not a time for conquest. This was a time for deliverance. God's work this time was not against Israel as it was in the Roman invasion, as it was in the Babylonian invasion. This time, triumph was to come from Israel's side. And we see amongst these people of Israel a spirit of determination, a spirit of survival, and a spirit which really can only be induced by the circumstances which they were in. This road here is a sign of the desperation of the people of Jerusalem. David Ben-Gurion believed that Jerusalem was crucial strategically and psychologically. Believed it was crucial strategically because of the position of Jerusalem reaching out into that territory there. He believed that there was a risk if they lost Jerusalem that Israel could be cut in two, and two states of Israel would be a disaster and a failure, and they'd be doomed essentially with the Arab armies around them. And we must remember that with every war, there's not just the military side, but the political side. Whenever Israel were fighting their war, they weren't sure how it was going to finish, even from a political side. But anyway, here is the Burma Road, named after a British road, which was down somewhere, I forget where. They decided, in desperation, that rather than send these convoys of vehicles up to Jerusalem via Latrun, they decided instead to dig their own road. And so they sent in bulldozers to actually dig a road up the crevices and nooks and crannies of the steep side leading up to Jerusalem. This was reported. Someone spotted this, as the Jews believed they would. And here's just another example of where just little things happen. The 1948 history is full of this, and I can strongly recommend anyone to read the book Old Jerusalem just to see those many incidents where we see the finger of God working for Israel. It was reported by Colonel Habiz Majali. He'd observed the bulldozers. He knew what was happening. So he reported it. and here's the response of the English journal Ashton. Some of these English journals were fighting on the side of the Arabs here. And he says, the terrain is too tough, it's too mountainous. They'd never get a road through there. Under no condition are you to waste your 25 pound of ammunition in the sector Beit Jesusi. And so, the Israelis get the road right up to the top. However, before they finish the road, Ben-Gurion gets a plea from David Shaltiel in Jerusalem. I think it was David Shaltiel, or it may have been someone else, who said, we're desperate. We have enough food to last us 24 hours, if that. We're going to have starvation in the city. And so the Haganah, another example of the Jewish spirit of fight and determination, they go to Tel Aviv. All the 18-year-olds to 30-year-olds were already in action. So they go to Tel Aviv, and the average age of these people was about 50 years old. They put them on a bus, took them to Jerusalem, loaded them with rucksacks, and said, you're going to walk up to Jerusalem with these bags of food and save the city of Jerusalem. The terrain, as we mentioned, was tough, and there was one man who had a heart attack. But clambering up sometimes with all fours, these people made it to Jerusalem and enabled the citizens of Jerusalem to survive another 36 plus hours just whilst they were building that Burma road. Another thing which was providential was a ceasefire which came into effect shortly after this was going on. This gave Israel the chance to import their awaited arms. The Arabs, actually, who weren't doing as well as they might have expected, they supported a ceasefire. Even though Israel, particularly like Jerusalem, were on the brink of starvation and collapse. And Hasan Pasha, who led the Jordanian armies, he said, what do you think the Jews will do with a ceasefire? Do you think they will do nothing? They will use it too, and you will find them twice as strong as you are afterward. He was absolutely right. Ben-Gurion knew it also. He said that his foes had made that day a mistake, a fateful mistake, and he knew that they would win. Around about that time, the time of the ceasefire, they started to receive their ships of ammunition, which had come from Czechoslovakia, somewhat ironic, that country which had been the first to fall to Hitler. And they had, this time they had anti-aircraft guns, they had shells, they had cannons and machine guns, 7 million rounds of ammunition. The Arabs, on the other hand, were not able to take advantage of this. The orders were blunt and unequivocal from the British, said Glum. Not one cartridge. The British would not give one single cartridge to Glum and his team amongst the Jordanians. And the Egyptians said he was getting chocolate, biscuits and tea, but no bullets. And so Israel won the war. And the ceasefire came into effect before they could gain the conquest of Jerusalem. They were on the brink of conquering Jerusalem because the tide had turned after that peace treaty, the truce. The tide had turned. So we must move on now to the Sinai campaign. And I suppose briefly, all we can say about this war is that briefly it broke the image of Israel as a fledgling state, not able to stand up and fight as a modern nation. This showed that the nation of Israel were now a real power to reckon with. And it also introduced two powers onto the world stage which have since dominated the politics of the Middle East, and that is Russia and USA. Those were on the same side on this occasion, and they both agreed that Israel should return the Sinai, even though they very swiftly, in remarkable speed and conquest, they defeated the Egyptians in Sinai and won the war. but once again politics prevailed and they relinquished their conquest and gave the land back to Egypt. So the Six-Day War. Spend a bit of time on this one, a very interesting one. Particularly from our point of view as Christadelphians, what we see there is Abdel Nasser in the middle and the Soviet Premier Khrushchev. This battle was not just a battle of Egypt and Syria, Iraq and Jordan. It was that, but more than that, this was a battle which was sponsored by Russia. Russia really were the driving force, as I see it, behind what was going on here. Of course, Nasser wanted to do this. Nasser wanted to defeat Jerusalem. He was a rabid anti-Semite, there's no doubt about that. But who gave him the arms? Who empowered him to do so? It was the Russians. Now, King Hussein of Jordan was not really into this, but he felt that he couldn't risk his life by not getting involved, because the Arab people are not fond of the Jews, and they'd do anything to have a war, despite what it involves, and despite the fact that they always lose. So he obliged and he complied with Nasser's request. He gave his army to Nasser's. June 5th, and Israel decides to take the preemptive strike. It's described as preemptive, that's in some ways a bit subjective, because Nasser had already closed the Straits of Tehran. So where was the first act of aggression? It was, in my view, clearly on the side of the Egyptians, but without getting too hung up in terminology. As far as an act of warfare, Israel was the first to do this, and they decided that they would take this preemptive strike. And on the first day of the war, they went at dawn at the coffee break of the Egyptian pilots and wiped out the Egyptian air force. And you can see those places, all the places they bombed. Basically, before 12 o'clock on the first day, the war was won. Israel had a superiority. It was just a matter of making advantage of what they gained there to be able to gain the conquests necessary within that period of time before the United Nations would interfere and stop the action. Generally speaking, the United Nations leave the Arabs do what they want, but when Israel do something, everyone gets together and stops it. So the first day of the war was when they went into bombed the air bases. They also made some inroads into the Sinai. The second day, they made a little bit of a deeper incursion into the Sinai, and they asked the Jordanians not to get involved, but the Jordanians had been told by the Egyptians that everything was going swimmingly and that they were defeating the Israelis and everything was hunky-dory, so the Jordanians got involved. So they started fighting the Jordanians. The Jordanians, incidentally, were shelling Tel Aviv. On this day was the fighting in Jerusalem. And this was the day of the fighting on Ammunition Hill. You've got a picture there in one of the trenches. This was the kind of warfare. This was not the kind of warfare they'd been facing back in 1948. This was like the trench-to-trench kind of warfare, which involved a lot of bloodshed. A lot of blood was spilled in Ammunition Hill, both sides, the Jordanians and the Israelis. But it was a strategic point for the Jordanians, and with the conquest of Ammunition Hill and French Hill, I think was another one, they managed to get some strategic positions in Jerusalem. Which leads us on to day three, where there's further excursions into the Sinai. The IDF troops have moved into the West Bank, and the Jordanian troops are also retreat. And we have the news that comes forth the Temple Mount is in our hands. And so the Jews once again put their hands upon the Western Wall, which to them is the holiest place of Jerusalem. And we can see that the invasion of Sinai is complete there. One other interesting event on this day was when the USS Liberty was hit by the Jews. Interesting to us because we see once again the balance of power that there was at this time. The USS Liberty had not heard, had not been communicated with, and hadn't been told to vacate the area. It was an American ship, and it was hit by the Israelis. They assumed it wasn't an Israeli ship, so they hit it. Transpired it was an American ship, much to the horror of the Jews. But the initial fear of the Jews when they heard about what had happened was that it was a USSR ship, or Russian ship rather. The American fear was that they had been hit by the Russians. So there was fear on both parties, the Americans and the Jews, that they were dealing with Russia. So it was actually a relief to both President Johnson and to the Israelis that this was actually friendly fire. So they paid compensation to the families of the people who were killed. But just interesting as you see what's really going on behind the scenes there. So there's the Sinai which was conquered on that day. So thus Egypt's power was neutralized, and they were taken out of the war. The only thing that remained was the north and dealing with Syria. Now Moshe Dayan was frightened of dealing with the Soviets, and he vetoed a decision to go into Syria, but decided for whatever reason he changed his mind and issued instructions to the military to go and do what they could before an impending ceasefire, which they knew would come sooner or later. And so they basically could have marched up to Damascus, they could have gone as far as they wanted, but they decided just to gain those conquests, to regain those areas in the Golan Heights, which once again fell into Israeli hands. I think this is a picture of some significance. This is now standing on modern day Israeli territory, down in the haze towards the Sea of Galilee, or to the top right, you can just pick it out. Looking to the left at the former Jewish synagogue at the time of Jesus. And this is the area of Gamla, which Josephus describes. And this was another of the many cruel massacres of the Romans in their invasions around the time of AD 70. And that village there, living in Gamla, was massacred. But what we see there is the turn of events. God was against them in AD 70. And he was for them in 1967. And we see the remarkable, miraculous events which transpire when God is on their side, and the reverse when he is not. And so the ceasefire came into effect on June the 10th, and Israel now have a territory which is three times what it was before. Signs of God's hand. What time did I start?
I need to be finishing,
do I? Okay. We'll speak now then of Armageddon briefly, where we read that all nations would again be gathered against Jerusalem to battle, and the city would be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city would go forth into captivity. At that time, two parts therein would be cut off and die, and the third would be left therein, and the Jerusalem would become a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, when they shall be in the siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem. and that Jerusalem would be a burdensome stone. What follows is the second Exodus, when the remaining Jews left in the land would be returned, and thus the Jews are favoured once again and become the head of all nations instead of the tail. Sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion, for lo, I come and I dwell in the midst of thee, saith Yahweh, and Yahweh shall inherit Judah his portion in the Holy Land, and shall choose Jerusalem again. And there we have the prophecy of the nations desiring to take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. What does it mean to us? Well, it means that we need to think about ourselves. And Israel has been there for a while, but just because we don't really realise the gravity of what we're dealing with doesn't mean that it's not a sign of great significance and great moment. Brother Thomas says there will be a pre-eventual limited colonisation of the country by Jews and the protectorate of Britain. However, the colonisation we talk about, it will be a sign of the time indicative of the speedy coming of Christ. There are signs that the practiced eye can already see, but that will be a sign which, if men were not stone blind, no one could fail to discern aright. It is for us, brethren and sisters, not to be stone blind. Paul said in Romans chapter 11 that the fall of the Jews meant the richness of the Gentiles. But what would their receiving in mean but life from the dead? Israel's return to us is a sign of the imminent return of Christ and life from the dead of all his faithful servants of the past. And for us who are alive and remain, it's a sign that we really are and have been in a time of great significance, a turning point in history, which is an ongoing sign that the end of all things is indeed at hand.